I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. We talk about Antarctica now with the poet and teacher Jay Rzeski. He's just written a new book in Antarctica, An Amundsen Pilgrimage. He writes of the life and times of his ancestor, Roald Amundsen, and his exploration of the South Pole. Jay's great-grandfather's cousin was the first human to set foot there in 1911. 100 years later, Mr. Rzeski goes to Antarctica himself, and you read about his adventure in this book. I've started it, and it's hard to put down. This Sunday, the 23rd of June, 2013, Jay Rzeski will be speaking at 2 p.m. at the Vancouver Maritime Museum about this book. There'll be a slideshow, too. Jay Rzeski is a professor in the Creative Writing Department at Vancouver Island University in Duncan, British Columbia. He is an editor at the Malahat Review and the co-founder of Outlaw Editions. His previous novel, The Wolzenberg Clock, was prize-nominated, and his poetry collections have been published to great critical acclaim. I'll ask Mr. Rzeski about his adventures, about Amundsen, and more. jrzeski.blogspot.com is the website for more. This book is published by Knightwood Editions. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Jay Rzeski. Mr. Rzeski, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks very much for talking to me today.
Thanks for doing this. As I said in the introduction, I'm really enjoying this book. I understand, having heard an interview you did with the CBC in Victoria, that you started this book in the late 80s. Is that correct?
Yeah, I did. I went to university out here at the University of Victoria, and then I went to graduate school at the University of Windsor because Alistair MacLeod was there at the time. And so he was my a thesis advisor at the University of Windsor, and it was a place where I had some time and space. Graduate school was kind of beautiful for me. I had some time and space to work on a lot of things, and my thesis was actually a poetry manuscript that became my first book. But at the same time, I started thinking about this story, and the thing is that I had grown up with all these stories of Amundsen. Right, he was my family's claim to fame, as I think I've said before, and every family finds a way to, you know, tie themselves to some kind of fame. You know, you might be the distant great grandchild of the, you know, illegitimate child of the czar, or, you know, there's some connection to some Hollywood star or something. But, you know, families try to find a way to link themselves to that if they're not doing it themselves. And so these stories were very much a part of my growing up. You know, Amundsen's his Northwest Passage expedition, and of course his South Pole expedition. And one of the things about his expedition was that he got to the South Pole before Scott did, and I think perhaps one of his flaws was that he made it seem a little easier than it was. It was a very, very difficult thing that he did, and minus 60 degree temperatures and incredible obstacles. But he didn't emphasize the difficulties, he emphasized his success, which, you know, makes sense when you think about it, but it doesn't make as good a story. And so as I got older and I began sort of reading versions of his story, largely through his diaries and his own account of his trip to the South Pole, and then other people's writing about Antarctica, there are lots and lots of sort of fictional versions or fictionalized tellings of Scott's expedition to the Robert Falcon Scott's expedition to the South Pole, because he struggled more. He faced a lot of adversity, and in fact, he was martyred there. He died, you know, for his cause. Amundsen went and was successful and came back, and that's not as good a story. But I felt like there was a good story there. I felt like there was something really to tell, and so when I was in graduate school, I began thinking about, well, maybe there was a way for me to tell this story, because no one else had done it. No one else had written. In fact, I think. I've been pretty thorough in my research, and there isn't really another fictional telling of the story. So this book represents that. And I started thinking about it then in graduate school back there. It was 1989. And I began a version of it, and in fact finished around the year 2000. I finished a draft, and the story had another fictional frame where there were two other characters, and one of them was a cartographer, and that's kind of his involvement in the story. And when I finished it, I felt like, well, good, this is just exactly the novel that I sort of set out to write when I finished grad school back in 89, and now it's 12 years later, and it's just what I wanted to do back then. But I also realized, but it's not what I would do if I were to start over, right? And, you know, a lot of things develop over the course of a 12-year kind of apprenticeship. And so when I was finished, I looked at it, and I was pleased that I'd done what I'd set out to do, but not really pleased with what it was anymore, and I thought there was something missing. And it ended up sort of getting shelved for a couple of years, and toward the middle of the first decade of this century, I started thinking very seriously about trying to get to the South Pole, that maybe what was missing was from the story was myself, that I felt like my own personal connections actually were part of the story, that growing up and hearing those stories, and that really was part of the tale itself, you know. So so I started thinking about ways to get there, and I, in fact, I did, so that became, I started to realize that the story needed to be told in a different way, and with me in it, and what made sense was that I would try to go there on the 100th anniversary of his visit to Antarctica, and so that's what I did.
So that was in 2011?
Yeah, that's right.
And I'll ask you about the logistical stuff, because that also interests me. But in terms of looking for a connection to Amundsen, you obviously were related to him, but in reading the book thus far, I get a sense that you want a closer connection to him. And once you got to Antarctica, once you saw what he saw and took the path that he took, did you feel that at all?
I think that at first I didn't necessarily want a closer connection to him, in that I didn't want to feel like I was like him.
Yeah.
Because at first I actually really didn't like him. You know, one of the things I struggled with growing up and hearing those stories was that his sort of really ruthless efficiency, that kind of sense of him as a fairly cold person, you know, who just wanted to get something done and did it. And the one part of that that's really complicated for me is that his relationship with dogs.
The sled dogs that he...
Yeah, sled dogs, because he had learned from the Northern Inuit when he was in the Northwest Passage how to handle and drive dogs and how efficient and useful they were. And so his plan to go to the South Pole always included taking teams of dogs and having them transport all the... Who do you want hauling your tons of goods? Do you want to do it yourself, or do you want, you know, 13 huskies doing it? And it makes a lot of sense to have the dogs. But part of the plan also involved getting all the way up to the Antarctic Plateau. It's 3,000 meters higher than the ice shelf where they landed with the ship. So up across the Trans-Antarctic Mountains, and then sacrificing some of the dogs, because once you're all the way up there, you don't really need that much sort of, you know, dog power anymore. And so he could sacrifice some of the dogs, feed them to the other dogs, and eat them himself, and make it the rest of the way and back without any trouble. And that's what he actually, that's what he did. And I was always really troubled by you know, how could you do that? How could you? I love dogs, so I just couldn't understand how anybody could do that with his dogs. So I was really troubled by who he was at first. And I think it was over the course of a lot of research and a lot of reading and a lot of kind of getting to understand him and what he did that softened a little bit. So that I began to understand that what happened with the dogs, that whole plan to sacrifice them, that there was a lot of personal sacrifice involved too. I mean, they didn't eat each other, but they certainly drove their bodies to the edge of being, and they didn't expect anything less from the dogs. So there was a little bit, you know, I had a little more sympathy for what he was doing then, and also you have to start, you know, it's the whole argument about our relationship with animals. I do eat them, so I have to question myself, well, I'm fine with, you know, eating that cow or that pig, so why am I not okay with him eating one of the dogs?
Yeah.
It's an interesting ethical question. When I was there, though, I did feel, I think there was this, by the time I got to Antarctica, I did feel a kind of a kinship. I mean, I was sailing around in all these areas where he had been.
Uh-huh.
And he loved the polar regions. I mean, for him, being in at the north and deep south, that's where he felt at home. And I had a very odd moment one morning out on the deck, wondering, what am I feeling? I'm feeling something, and I realized what I was feeling was I was feeling at home. You know, I was feeling belonging, so I did end up feeling quite a kinship with him, I think.
Yeah, so you obviously didn't take dogs with you down there on your journey in 2011. You took a ship, is that right?
Yeah, you can't take dogs down there anymore since the end of the last century, about 1991, I think, dogs and all other non-indigenous species have been banned from Antarctica.
Uh-huh.
And it's just a sort of thing with the treaty organization that you don't really want. There are no, you know, there are no natural predators on land in Antarctica, and the penguins and seals and so on don't have any predators on land, so you don't really want dogs or any other animals being there when they shouldn't be. So so that's part of it. Yeah, but so I was on a ship. And in fact, I didn't get all the way to the South Pole. That was one of the things. That's one of the things about this story is that Amundsen's trip was, in a way, not the trip that he wanted to be taking. He wanted to go to the North Pole, but it was claimed a couple years before before he was set to get going, and so he turned his attention south. And when he landed at the South Pole, he thought. How, you know, this is completely upside down. This is the last place on Earth that I really wanted to be. It's far away from my goal as I could possibly imagine. And I wanted to be at the South Pole, and instead I ended up along the Antarctic Peninsula because I couldn't manage practically to get all the way to the South Pole. But in the end, I felt like that was maybe a better place to be. He had been along the peninsula as a younger man. When he was 25 years old, he was second mate on a ship called the Belgica, and it was his first experience in Antarctica. And he sailed through pretty much, I sailed his route. I mean, I sailed all the places that he had been as a 25-year-old mate on Belgica. So I followed very much in his footsteps, just not the footsteps I thought I was going to follow in.
Yeah. So how much does a thing like this cost? And you opened the book by going to the bank because you figure it'll cost X amount of money, and you try to get a loan, right?
Yeah.
You didn't get the loan. in the end, how did you get the money, and how did you make your way down there?
Well, the amount of money I'm referring to in the opening of the book is an amount of money that you travel in the 21st century is quite a bit different than travel in 1911, and in the 21st century, you can go pretty much anywhere you want. You know, you can get somebody to yank you up Mount Everest, or paddle you down the Amazon, or take you, you know, whatever remote area you want to go if you have enough money. And the South Pole is no exception. You can pay. There's an eco-tourist company that runs trips there where you basically sort of fly into the Antarctic Plateau, and they drop you off, and then you ski the last sort of 100 kilometers or so with a guide to the South Pole, and it's an eco adventure tour you can take. You have to be relatively fit to do it, and you have to have somewhere around $85,000-$90,000 to go. And you know, that was way out of my price range, and not something I was sure I wanted to do anyway, quite that way. So the other way to get the way I was really investigating getting to the South Pole was that the National Science Foundation in the United States has a program called the Antarctic Artists and Writers in Residence Program, which in which they hook up artists and writers and filmmakers with other scientific and military expedition military operations that are going on in Antarctica. So essentially, you know, if there's a Hercules going from McMurdo Sound to South Pole Station, it doesn't really cost the military or the National Science Foundation any much money to stick a poet on it, right? And that's the way I was trying to get to the South Pole. But around the time when I had to be applying, when I was making applications or wanted to be considered for that program, it was 2008 and the recession had hit, mm-hmm. and the whole National Science Foundation was kind of in swamp and disarray. So that didn't work out either. I couldn't even get anybody on the phone or by email anymore, and that didn't work. So I actually gave up. I thought, well, I'm not going to go. I thought this maybe was something that was going to happen, and it's not. And then around 2010, I started thinking, well, maybe I could go. You know, maybe I could still, you know, I knew there were tourist expeditions that went down, particularly to the peninsula where I went, and I started looking it up, and it didn't take very long to find a ship, and within several months, I sort of had booked passage and was on my way. And it can cost you anywhere from probably the low end that it would cost you if you flew straight to Ushuaia or Punta Arenas in the bottom of Argentina and Chile. The least it would cost you is somewhere around, you know, $12,000 to $15,000, and you can spend an awful lot more money than that depending on the tourist trip that you go on. There are cruise ships that go down to Antarctica, so if you want, you can do a sort of champagne tour of Antarctica. But the expedition I was on was pretty basic. It was a refitted Russian research vessel, 235 feet and 54 passengers. So it was there was nothing luxurious about it, but it was perfect for what I wanted to do.
Yeah, and so you went with your brother, is that correct?
Yeah, I like any ship like that, if you have a, you know, it costs a lot of money to go on your own because you have to pay for a, uh-huh, a cabin on your own. And so I was looking for a shipmate. I traveled a little bit with my brother before, and he's a wealthy entrepreneur in Alberta, and so he was the only person I could think of who had the money and probably could arrange the time to go. So I called him up and asked him if he wanted to go to Antarctica, and he very quickly said yes, that he would.
His name's Scott, right?
Yeah, that's right. So he asked me, this is in the book as well, he asked me somewhere along the way, he said, well, you know, which one of us is Amundsen, right? Which one of us is playing this role? And I pointed out to him, I said, well, you know, first of all, you don't look Norwegian. You have the Ukrainian genes. You look like, you know, a Ukrainian guy, dark hair. And then your name is Scott, I said. So so he just let it go at that.
Yeah. In terms of what you saw and in terms of what Amundsen saw, is there much that's changed in 100 years?
Well, there is. Although I don't think I'm the best judge of that. The one of the things about the Antarctic is that it is still, despite what I'm saying about, you know, the tourist expeditions down there and so on, there's still a relatively small number of people that visit Antarctica. Somewhere around 25,000 people, tourists a year, go down there. And, you know, to get that into perspective, that about 40,000 tourists a day go to Disneyland, right? So, so it's not that many people, and it is still a very pristine wilderness. You know, there are not cigarette butts washing up on the beach. There is no flotsam in the water that doesn't belong there, and it's a place where human activity is at a minimum. You know, there are some research stations and so on, but really you don't see a lot of evidence of humanity there. And so in a way, it hasn't changed very much. In that way, it hasn't changed very much. The Antarctic Treaty Organization is a really important thing in this world that's keeping it that way, keeping exploration at bay, mineral exploration and stuff like that at bay. At the same time, the expedition leader I was with, a guy named Gary Miller, who is a biologist and had spent about 25 years working in the Antarctic, including overwintering there 1 year at a penguin colony near Mawson Station. He reported to me the drama of the changes that he'd seen. So bays that we'd sailed into that he'd been into 25 years before, you know, the amount of ice that was there and the receding of the glaciers was very obvious to him. So yeah, things are changing, and things are changing very quickly. And it's just like the Arctic, the changes in the environment, the global climate changes are much more evident in the south than they are in the north.
And I guess
than they are in the, you know, in where we live.
Yeah, and so I guess that's something that you see firsthand. I guess the changes of the planet, and in terms of that, and in terms of what you learn about, say, global warming and Earth, do you have any insight into life even after going down there?
Well,
I mean, it seems to me, I mean, you've already talked about it, and that's a sense that I got, that it was much more than a physical space. It was almost spiritual being down there.
It was very spiritual for me being there, not only because of the family connection, but just because of the place. I mean, the wilderness that it is, being surrounded by ice, feeling so puny most of the time, right? Like the landscape is incredibly overwhelming and huge and otherworldly. It's like nowhere else on Earth. I mean, only 2% of the continent is not completely covered in ice. So a lot of the time, sailing around those waters, it's sailing either, you know, there's the ocean and then there's ice, and so it's a very mythical seeming environment, and it's a landscape that sort of drives you, I think, to think spiritually about what the world is and what life is, because it's also like stepping away. It's like, you know, reading reports from astronauts or cosmonauts on the space station or, you know, up on the moon, having stepped away from the home planet the way that they have, it makes you consider what your sort of day-to-day life is. And Antarctica does that too. You sort of very much step away from your life into this, I suppose actually if you think about old descriptions of, you know, people's imagination, what they imagine heaven to be like, right, sort of floating around on clouds, well, it actually kind of looks like that down there, floating around on icebergs. And so it's a very spiritually enchanted place, and it makes you think about your day-to-day life in a huge way. Absolutely. I felt it was just a huge gift, and I felt like part of going down there, I felt just so lucky. I felt like, man, my life has been like, look at what's happening in my life. I get to be here. Like, this is something really good is happening for me.
Would you go back?
Oh, I would love to go back. Yeah, I'd love to go back, and I would love actually to go deeper into the continent. It was amazing being along the peninsula, but I'd love to get to the South Pole Station, or just even deeper into the continent. It'd be a very different experience than what I had.
How cold was it?
Well, you know, you can only really, especially as a tourist, and in fact most scientists too, you can only really go there in the austral summer. So that's why I was there in December, and that's why Amundsen was racing for the pole in December. And at that time of year along the peninsula, the temperature is pretty moderate. I mean, it was mostly hovering around zero, a little bit above some days, a little bit below some days. It wasn't much colder maybe than minus 10 on a really cold day on the peninsula. Inland, it gets an awful lot colder than that. But again, at that time of year, that's when it's warmer. So Amundsen was facing temperatures more like sort of minus 20 or something like that. And on the plateau at that time of year, that's pretty toasty.
Now, I understand there's actually, I was at the Royal BC Museum about a month or two ago, and a half ago, and they were setting this up, and so it wasn't open yet. But there's an exhibit there, and I'm told that there is some stuff there that's Amundsen's.
Yeah, it's the exhibit's called The Race to the Pole, and it's an exhibit about the competition between Robert Falcon Scott and Roald Amundsen to get to the pole. And I was at the opening actually, and I've been there again since with my dad. And It's a fantastic exhibit, and what it does is it kind of takes you through both of their stories, and that's what's so wonderful about it, is you kind of see both of these men and their teams and what they were, you know, how they went about preparing to go, and then what happened to them on their way. And so it sort of takes you into both of their stories, and it's a beautiful exhibit that way. And there are a number of artifacts, including one of the things that's there is Amundsen took with him an early film camera, right, a cinematograph. It was 1911, so this was brand new technology, and that camera is there, and so is one of his sledges and some other artifacts like that.
What did he do after he came back from Antarctica?
Well, he came back to Norway, and one of the first things he did is he toured around. The way he raised money for from one expedition to the next was to go around on big lecture tours. I mean, he went all across North America and the UK and Europe, and he spoke. There's a little plaque in the subway station underneath Carnegie Hall in New York with his name on it, because that was one of his stops on his big lecture tour. And so he would speak to big rooms full of people, I mean hundreds or thousands of people, and he had lantern slides, so glass slides. Some of them they were hand tinted to make them more presentable, and so he would do these talks about his expeditions. And that's one of the first things he did, is he went on a great big tour to talk about his trip. And then when he got back to Norway, eventually because he had made promises to go to the north, that's when the planning for his expedition was about that. He felt like he needed to sort of fulfill that promise, and to some of his backers and so on, they had forgiven him for going to the South Pole instead, especially because he was successful. But he did feel a certain commitment to follow through with what he said he was going to do, which is to drift up through the Northeast Passage and try to drift close to the pole. So that's what he did, and that trip didn't go so well for him.
What are penguins like? I mean, and how close did you get to them?
Penguins are wonderful. You know, it's
like we've all seen that movie, the one that Morgan Freeman narrated.
Yeah.
And you know, we all have sort of an affection for them. And you're a guy who's gotten much closer than I have. So I'm wondering what they're like.
Penguins are. It's hard not to anthropomorphize them. You know, I mean, anybody. You know, you ought not to do that. You ought not to think about animals in our terms, right?
Those
they're
people.
Not like us. Yeah. And but. But they are like beautiful little people, and they're just. And what's beautiful about them is that they're so kind of vulnerable and so open, right? They as I said, they don't have any natural predators on land. All their predators are in the sea. So when they're in the water, they're very graceful and very fast. But they're also in danger because leopard seals and orcas and so on want to eat them. But when they're on land, that there aren't any natural predators. So they're just not naturally afraid of anybody, of people or anything else, and they're very curious. They sort of walk up and look at what you're doing, and I think that it's their, you know, it's the combination of their feathers, their coloring, because they do look like they're wearing little tuxedos, kind of, and you know the way they sort of waddle up and they're kind of, you know, they fall down and slip on the ice and do all kinds of things that we do. So it's hard not to anthropomorphize them a little bit and to be a little bit endeared by them too, because they just seem. So charmingly vulnerable, like I said, and I could watch them for hours and hours. And we visited a lot of penguin colonies. The biggest one was about 300,000 penguins on Deception Island, but a lot of the penguin colonies were a lot smaller. Part of the treaty organization's sort of guidelines for approaching wildlife in the Antarctic is that you should try to stay sort of 5 meters away from anything that's not dangerous, like a penguin or a Weddell seal, and quite a bit farther away from anything that is dangerous, like a fur seal or a leopard seal. But the penguins don't really care about that, and you know, you can stay 5 meters away from them, but that doesn't mean they'll stay 5 meters away from you. They will approach and wonder what you're doing and peck at your toes and things like that. And some of the places where I was, the colonies, it's hard to stay that far away from them. But they also seem pretty unfazed by people. I was quite close to some penguins that were nesting and had just hatched, sort of day or two day old chicks, and they really didn't seem too concerned about human activity near them. You know, it might be that they're dumb. It might be just they're really stupid. I'm not sure. Like chickens, or you know, but I don't like to think of them that way. They seem too charming for that.
Yeah, it's been such a pleasure talking to you today, Jay, and I'm really looking forward to finishing this book. It's a really great read, and I'm not just saying that because you're on today. Congratulations on it. Continued good luck with it.
Okay, Joe, thanks very much. Good to talk to you, too.
The event is this Sunday, the 23rd of June at 2 p.m. That's at the Vancouver Maritime Museum. Jay will be speaking there, and there'll be a slideshow, and you can go down there, buy the book, and get it signed. JayRozeski.blogspot.com is the website for more. The book is called In Antarctica, an Amundsen Pilgrimage. It's published by Knightwood Editions. Its author, Jay Rozeski, on the line. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.